Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Walter O. Evans has spent decades collecting, curating, and conserving a wide variety of African-American art, music, and literature in an effort to preserve the cultural history of African-Americans. Part of his collection focuses on the 19th century formerly enslaved statesman and abolitionist Frederick Douglass, circa 1818 to 1895. In addition to inscribed books from Douglass's and his descendants' libraries and printed editions of his speeches, the collection contains letters, manuscripts, and photographs. Much of the material is of a personal nature: correspondence between family members, family histories, and scrapbooks compiled by Douglass and his children. The scrapbooks, with their personal documents and familial relationships, illuminate Douglass in ways never seen before. In 2018, Celeste Marie Bernier and Andrew Taylor of the University of Edinburgh published If I Survive, Frederick Douglass and Family in the Walter O. Evans Collection, a guide to the collection born of a long-standing collaboration between the authors and Dr. Evans. Within its pages, they have reproduced letters, manuscripts, and photographs from the collection, along with transcriptions and commentary that provide an invaluable resource for Douglass scholars. On Friday, April 26, 2019, in conjunction with the exhibition In the Library, Frederick Douglass Family Materials from the Walter O. Evans Collection at the National Gallery of Art, Bernier speaks with Evans about the role of his collection in scholarship on Douglass and the preservation of Douglass's legacy for a new generation of Americans.
Thank you all so much for being here. We are so thrilled to be here again. Like bad pennies, we return. Thank you all so much for having us. I'd also like to thank Ali, Sarah, Terrence, and everyone. I'm not sure where you are right now, but thank you very much for having us. We're going to run today as a conversation, and we would like to give you some kind of sense of the Dr. Walter O. and Linda Evans collection. We'd like to talk to you about Mr. Douglass and family, and we'd also like to talk to you about the world collection and traveling show that this has and continues to be that Roger spoke to us about just a moment ago. But I'd like to begin the conversation with the heart of the matter and the life of where all this started by asking Dr. Evans to tell us and to share his beautiful stories about how and when his book and documents collection began.
Okay, so how did this book and document collection begin? Many of you, and I recognize several of you out in the audience here, know about the art collection that I started. But let's go back all the way. Born in Savannah, Georgia, many years ago. Moved when I was a child to Beaufort, South Carolina, and then as a teenager to Hartford, Connecticut. After graduating from high school, I didn't go right into college, but I went into the Navy. Up until that time, I had never been in an art museum in my life. In the South, we just weren't welcomed. And in the North, as a teenager, that just wasn't one of the places that I frequented very often. However, not long after I went into the Navy, I was transferred to Philadelphia, and not long after I arrived in Philadelphia, I met a young lady, and on our first date, she wanted to go to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Having never been in an art museum in my life, I went to the library down the street, Ben Franklin Parkway, and I read all about the artists that I would see. And when we got to the museum, I started telling her about all of these artists, mostly French Impressionists. There weren't any African-American art hanging on the walls, but there was lots of American and European art. And I started telling her about, Lautrec and Van Gogh and Monet and Degas and so many of the others, and she was duly impressed. And while that relationship didn't last, my love of art museums did. But I came down here to Washington to Howard University, and actually before going on Howard's campus, I came to this very museum before going further north here to Howard, to my studies. And I remember seeing Salvador Dali's The Last Supper, and it was just so amazing, and among other things here. Okay, so let's skip forward through undergraduate school, medical school, and residency, and starting my practice. I continued to go to museums. I traveled a lot doing breaks from school to Europe, and I visited the museums there and all of the museums in every city. What I didn't tell you is that not only was this young lady interested in art, she also got me interested in reading. I had not done a lot of reading prior to meeting her. I remember her telling me about Richard Wright's Native Son and Black Boy. And so I went to the library, or the on base in Philadelphia, we had a fairly decent library, so I checked books out of there. And again, this habit stuck with me. Throughout college, medical school, I bought paperbacks of some of the common African-American books, but not just those books. I bought some classics, British, Russian, French classics, and I started reading those books at the time. I know this is a long answer, but I'm getting...
No, take your time. Take your time.
So when I earned my first dollars, I started buying art. I was very lucky with the art because I had advisors, and my first purchase was a Jacob Lawrence cereal set. I also started buying first edition books because, you know, before this time I was just buying paperbacks and, you know, some of my favorites, Frantz Fanon and Richard Wright and Langston Hughes, et cetera. But I didn't really know what I was doing in collecting first editions. It wasn't until a couple years later, and by chance, I was visiting New York. My practice was in Detroit, by the way. But I was visiting New York, and I stopped by the Strand Bookshop. I would stop to bookshops in every city I visited, and The Strand is a huge bookshop down on Broadway and 11th or 12th Street, and they have contemporary books on the first floor, but upstairs they had rare and some antiquarian books. Coming down on the elevator, I met a fellow who would change my life forever. He asked me, he said, "Did you find what you were looking for?" And I said, "Not really." So he pulled out his card, and he said, "Well, come by my shop tomorrow." This was a Saturday night, about 10 o'clock. That bookstore stayed open until about midnight-ish, at least. And I said, "Tomorrow is Sunday." He said, "No problem." He said, "Give me a call. I'll be there." So about 10 o'clock Sunday morning, I went by his bookshop, not knowing that this fellow was Glenn Horowitz, and he's the most renowned antiquarian book dealer, not just in the United States, but in the world to this day. So it wasn't an ordinary bookshop. His salon, I'll call it, was up on the 30th floor or whatever in this building on Lexington Avenue near Grand Central, 46th Street, I believe. And I went in there, and we sat in this these leather chairs, and he started pulling out these books. I had never seen books this old in this condition. And he put several books in my hands, and he said, "You know, this should be in your collection." Well, there was one book I didn't want to let go, but I told him, "No, I just can't afford this four-figure book. I just wasn't used to." Before this time, I thought any first edition book was collectible. You know, and most of the ones I purchased prior to this time were tattered. It was the cheapest first edition I could possibly find. Well, this book was Folks from Dixie, and it was by Paul Laurence Dunbar, 1899. In fact, he published it while he was working in this city at the Library of Congress. So I said, "No, I can't do it. I can't buy any of this material. It's just way out of my range." So he said, "I'll tell you what. You take this book home with you, and if you like it and you want to keep it, you just pay me for it then. He said, keep it a couple weeks or whatever, and if you don't like it, just send it back. I didn't even know this man 12 hours before that. He must have thought I was honest or very, very dumb. And I think the latter, because that was the beginning of an addiction. And I'm in sort of remission now, but it took a long, long time. Well, over the next 5, even more than that, 10 years or so, every time I operated on a patient and did a gallbladder hernia, the funds I earned from that went to art and books. And I mean, I was had. And there were book dealers from that time on. He taught me about condition. He taught me about the importance of having dust jackets. Dust jackets didn't start appearing on books in the U.S. until the 1920s. But he taught me about association copies. I learned the language of the antiquarian book dealers and book collectors, which I had not known before. So that was the beginning of my book collecting. Now I guess you're here wanting to know about the Douglas material, and I'll get to that after first asking Celeste, how does a person from the United Kingdom get interested in African American art, books, studies, letters, etc.? Just how does that happen?
That's also a long story. we've been doing our double act for a few months now, so you might be able to tell that. But not on these questions. So I'm a white French Canadian Irish immigrant to the UK. And when I came into the UK, and as I'm sure it's no surprise to anyone in this room, Britain as a nation is far, far more interested in abolition. We are the nation of white men like Thomas Clarkson and William Wilberforce. We are not the nation that bought, sold, traded, raped, murdered, tortured, and pillaged for millennia. And so growing up in a community of Irish dissenters, the individuals, the descendants of the men and women that Mr. Douglas stayed with in Dublin, in Northern Ireland, and various other places, I had another sense of what national memory is. Still today, textbooks in the UK will tell the glorious narrative, as I'm sure you're aware, the white supremacist party, the Conservative Party, a few years ago, decided to change the curriculum. It decided to take Mary Seacole off the curriculum, to take off Alauda Equiano, founding fathers and founding mothers of black womanist radical revolutionary history, out of those schools and instead replace it with what they gloriously described as England for England's story. So I came across my own addiction, so I empathize with you in addiction, and as Roger outlined all the things I've done, I see it in glorious technicolor, of starting to try and tell the story and to think through what is black revolutionary radicalism and resistance over centuries. Now, Mr. Douglas is really where the story began. I found his narrative in a secondhand bookstore, not a beautiful antiquarian one, but a secondhand bookstore in London, and I read it, and it changed my life. And Mr. Douglas, as you see him here in one of his very few smiling photographs, is a man who survived by any means necessary. And as reading his narrative, reading his story, and in the 20 years of my life I've spent researching his life, we've unearthed around 7,000 published and unpublished writings, speeches, manuscripts, and letters. Now, as we stand here and sit here in the National Gallery of Art, for Frederick Douglass, the act of the word and the art of representation was nothing less than life at stake. Now, in that journey, in that 20 years, we have the told story of Frederick Douglass, but where, oh, where is the untold story of the Frederick Douglass family? Why not I endure hardship so my race may be free? Those are the words, not of Mr. Douglas, but of Mrs. Anna Murray Douglas. Now, while Frederick Douglass wrote 7,000 words, what we have and what survives of what she said is contained in what I just said to you. Why not I endure hardships that my race may be free? So the question of how I became involved in thinking around African-American studies and African-American art and dedicating my life to it is really one that begins with Douglass and begins and ends with Anna Murray. Dead women, men, and children tell no tales. We know the millions. We don't know the uncounted millions who died in the Atlantic Ocean, who made that new world journey into a lifeless death and a deathless life, as Mr. Douglass described it. He talked himself all his life. When he spoke across the world, he said, "I have seen slavery. I know it in my bones and sinews. Were I to speak and use every word in the English language, you would still not know it. Language is cold, valueless, and lifeless." Now, that is how I became impassioned about art. And the joy and privilege and honor that keeps giving of working with Dr. Evans is thinking through the freedom struggle by every means necessary. Words are weapons. Quilts are weapons. The mind is a weapon, as Douglass spoke about it, in the worldwide fight to end discrimination, racism, and prejudice. What you're looking at here is a painting by Labena Hameed, a contemporary artist who recently won the Turner Prize, born in Zanzibar. And when I asked her to memorialize Frederick Douglass for me, she made a beautiful decision. We all know that Mr. Douglass, when he toured and spoke to thousands at a time, his beautiful artistry was the work of two women, Anna Murray and Rosetta. They are the ones sewing his clothing, making his linen so beautiful. In the big project I did on photography, which proved Mr. Douglass was the most photographed American, black or white, in history, what you see is extraordinary. No one looks like Frederick Douglass, and no one looks like him because of the costume prowess of his wife and his daughter. What she decided to do was to honor a sentence that Douglass says, where he says, "I learnt of my ancestry underneath the table, listening to the stories of grandmothers, grandfathers who came incarcerated in ships." What you're looking at are the lapels, the beautiful lapels of Mr. Douglass's jackets that she's made come and signify like birds. She also has pattern designs from West African kangas as she's honoring that quilting legacy. Claudette Johnson is a contemporary of Labena Hameed, and she's an artist that is very much preoccupied with what Frederick Douglass described and which Dr. Evans has described as dealing with the terrible loss of artworks that don't exist in galleries, that have never been shown. And she creates monumental, beautiful, a larger than life, as she describes it, black women and sisters that I know, we came to dance and we were denied. If you get a chance to see one of her artworks, it's so hard to see in reproduction. One of the things that Claudette Johnson does is she scarifies the paper. She deliberately wounds it. And Douglass talked all the time. He said of his photographs, he said, "My wounds, I could show you. Would that I could show you the wounds on my soul." So I really became powerfully inspired by the question of what is the freedom struggle? How do we understand it? How can we begin to imagine and picture it? And how do we deal with our own failures and our own problems in dealing with still white supremacist Western nations that want to dehumanize and invisibilize? But as I said and promised, all roads lead to Mr. Douglass and the family. And I'd like to ask you, Walter, to talk to us about your beautiful collection and share those stories with us.
Okay. What I didn't tell you just a little while ago is that while the art that I was collecting was quite celebrated, my wife, who's sitting in the back there, Linda, put together about 70 works, and we traveled exhibition of art through to over 50 museums. And when that, over a 16-year period, and after those tours ended, we still loan multiple works out to various museums. In fact, even right now, there are probably more than 100 works from our collections and of art collection in museums. Now, while the artwork was celebrated throughout the U.S. and Europe, the books and manuscripts and documents were not. Why is that? Because I never told anybody what I was doing with these with these books and manuscripts and documents. I was almost ashamed to. I mean, how could I tell someone the highs I got from buying, say, Jesse Forsett's Plum Bun? I mean, they wouldn't have known what I was talking about. They would say, this guy has been knocked in the head or something. And so I was, I never told anybody about, you know, all these hundreds and hundreds, even thousands of books that I was buying. And, you know, if I had been buying clothes and spending extraordinary amounts of, you know, money on that, it would probably would have been not a problem. So I kept this pretty much a secret until one day I was contributing some art to the Cabron Lee exhibition that was to take place in Paris. And this curator, David Sotif, came to the house in Savannah to look at art. And he looked on the shelves and saw all of these books. And by the time he finished, we were loaning over 125 objects, mostly books and manuscripts and periodicals, dealing with the African-American experience. And there was this focus mainly on the period from the Civil Rights Movement until the... from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. Now, curators must have, from the U.S., must have seen that, because shortly thereafter, curators from the U.S., just recently there was a Harlem Renaissance exhibition in Columbus, Ohio, the Columbus Museum of Art, and just about all of the books there came from our collection. So, now again, how did I get the Douglas material? Well, I had gotten the names of and addresses and telephone numbers of just about every antiquarian book dealer in America, and I would call them, and I knew all of them by first name, and they knew me. And when they had something important, they would call me. I didn't go to all of the shops. There was no internet in that day, but I got to know most of them, and when I could, I visited their shops, and at least in the cities in the Northeast and in the Midwest, and occasionally out West. Well, one day, I was this would have been in the early 80s, I was sitting in my office, and I got this catalog, and it was from McBlaine Books. He was, when I first started buying from him, he was in Des Moines, Iowa, but I think in the late 70s, early 80s, he moved to New Haven. And I called him immediately, and I said, Phil, I said, you didn't tell me that you had all this Douglas material available. I said, normally you would give me an advance notice. And he said, that's because I don't want you to have it. And he says, I want Yale University to have this. He said, this belongs at the Beinecke. And I said, Phil, and he's still in business today, by the way, and he'll verify the story. So I said, Phil, Yale is not going to pay you 10 cents for that. They would have paid him 10 cents, but not the figure that he was talking about. And he said, well, I still want them to have it. This does not belong in a private person's hands. I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I am going to send you half the deposit right now, and in 30 days, I'm going to send you the balance. I didn't even call him in 30 days. I marked it on my calendar, and I sent him the balance. And a week or so later, I got these volumes of boxes, just volumes. But the material was in pretty poor condition. I mean, it was over 150 years old. And so the first thing I did with it, I took it up to the University of Michigan Graduate Library, where I knew a fellow by the name of James Craven, and he was a conservator. And he knew how to do book bindings, et cetera, deacidify paper, et cetera. So I got everything. It took about 2 or 3 years, and everything was conserved. Then I built these leather and silk cases, which I built for all of my extremely important. I mean, I have hundreds of these cases for books and documents at my house right now. Those of you who were in charge of the material coming here have seen some of those cases. So anyway, after that, the Douglas material sat pretty dormant until about 12 years ago. This fellow by the name of David Blight, you may have heard his name. Last week he won the Pulitzer Prize for his Douglas book. He came to my house. First of all, I heard him speak to a group of high school teachers. And he, at the end of the talk, I went up to him and I said, I have a few Douglas items. I think you ought to see them. So he came to the house, and I shouldn't repeat this in public, but he said words to this effect. Darn, I've got to write another book. He had already written a couple of books on Douglas. So over the last 12 years, until his book was published last year, he came to the house about 15, 20 times. He would stay 4 or 5 days each time and study researching the material in this book. And but what happened was that he introduced this collection to other Douglas scholars. So there were a parade of Douglas scholars. He didn't introduce me directly to Celeste, but he introduced me to a lady that she was working with, Zoe Trodd, and Celeste didn't tell you, but she was at the University of Nottingham in England at the time. And Zoe Trodd told her about the collection, and I think Celeste was doing a sabbatical. No, she was doing a fellowship, I believe, in Memphis, and she came down, and she must have said words to that effect also. I've got to write another book. But let's let her tell you the story.
It's a great story. So I think I took the pathway that I thought I would write another book, but I've ended up writing many more, and I'm still learning. So the pictures of the individuals you see in front of us are made possible because of the Dr. Walter O. and Linda Evans collection. Rosetta Douglas Spragg, Lewis Henry Douglas, this gentleman on the far right you know, Frederick Douglass Jr., Charles Remond Douglas, and Annie Douglas. Now, the told story of Frederick Douglass is the untold story of the Frederick Douglass family. My bondage and my freedom is our bondage and our freedom. What you see when you look at Urie's beautiful exhibition, what you would have seen in Scotland, what you'll see in SCAD when the exhibition opens there in the fall, is that the Frederick Douglass family story is the Frederick Douglass family story of intergenerational trauma and intergenerational survival. Rosetta Douglas Spragg, months before she died, went almost entirely blind because she had spent her whole life proofreading and editing from the age of 9 Frederick Douglass's newspapers and his handwritten speeches. She is the one who told him, this is the woman's era and we are coming. She was a seminal feminist, political thinker, and philosopher. One of her repeated phrases that she told her father was, read, reflect, and act. Lewis Henry Douglas fought in the Civil War, was one of the people who stood beside Robert Gould Shaw as he died on the parapet at Fort Wagner. Lewis Henry Douglas was a freedom fighter and an activist. He was a prolific editor, thinker, radical. He aided his father at many political campaigns. He staged one of the first sit-ins at a government counter in Washington, D.C., when he refused to be removed when he was discriminated against in a segregated setting. And he wrote endless letters to a woman known Helen Amelia Le Guin, daughter of Jermaine Wesley Le Guin of the Underground Railroad King fame. And she was the woman who was the love of his life, who became his wife. And in the letters that he writes to her, and that you can see in Urie's collection and in the beautiful book, is he writes to her, if I die killed or wounded, I hope I die with my face to the foe in the service of humanity. Frederick Douglass Jr. led a very difficult life. He had all kinds of illnesses, psychological and physical, as did his father. Frederick Douglass, quiet as it's kept, suffered from suicidal depression a great deal of his life. And one of his key comforters was Rosetta. You see her writing to comfort her father. Frederick Douglass Jr. was an anti-lynching crusader. He was also a prolific writer, and he was the one who insistently said to his father in fighting for egalitarian labor reform, he said, "Forward should be our watchword." He was the one who was fighting against the nostalgic white supremacist myth of the South in the 1870s, and he says, "I cannot understand why I see our black men murdered and Ku Kluxed by the very white men who sought to destroy this nation." Charles Remon, the longest survivor and the great-great ancestor of Ken Morris, Charles Remon was a powerful, powerful figure. We celebrate Walt Whitman as a figure who stood by and sat with men as they died in the Civil War front lines. Charles Remon did the same. He helped the dead on their journey. He helped the wounded and the suffering. He watched them die as he himself fought a distinguished military service. And he was a figure who told his father, he said, "As I fight in this war for freedom, I will not desert. I will take a bullet first." Annie Douglas, whose date of death we didn't know, were it not for the beautiful scrapbooks that Dr. Evans owns, she died at the age of 10 years. 11 months, 3 days, and 7 hours. Why do we know so specifically? Because Frederick Douglass Jr. took it upon himself to be the historian for his family that Frederick Douglass could never be. As we know, Frederick Douglass all his life said, "Genealogical trees do not grow among slaves." He thought he was born in 1817. He'd be furious and confused as to why his 200-year anniversary was in 2018. When he was asked about his birthday, he said, "I have no interest in birthdays. They are recorded only by those who know." And so for Frederick Douglass's son, Frederick Douglass Jr., he was the one who took the namesake on and who decided to memorialize his youngest sister's death. Annie Douglass was a freedom fighter at 10 years old. She sat on the knee of John Brown. John Brown used her bricks to build a prototype model of the subterranean passway by which he sought to arm enslaved men to freedom. She wrote her father a letter that he received in Perth when he was on the run from Governor Wise, who sought his head in the wake of the Harper's Ferry Revolution. And she said, "That hard-hearted man said he must die. They took him half a mile from the jail and they hung him. So dies the freedom struggle." And she was 10. Now, when Douglas got this news, he was in Scotland. And part of our journey in beginning to tell the story of the family is beginning to tell the story of their freedom struggle. And the beautiful book that we did together, which is a pretty hefty beast, it's 900 pages and it's not light, is actually the short version of what I'm working on at the moment, which is the 3 volumes of their complete writings, which is 985 items. We haven't yet got to 1,000, but we're very nearly there. I've just finished transcribing, and one of Walter's favorites stories, I'm going to get in there first, is that I've lost my fingerprints. It's very difficult for the US immigration to let me into the country anymore because I've lost my fingerprints as the result of all my typing. But we have finally transcribed everything. So Strike for Freedom, the exhibitions that we've done together and the exhibition that began in Scotland, is really to show the priceless Frederick Douglass family writings that are held in the beautiful, inspirational Walter O. and Linda Evans collection. And we wanted to take it to Scotland. So as Walter said, I'm a traveling hobo in many ways. I was in Nottingham, Robin Hood country, and now I'm in Scotland. And I feel Mr. Douglass put me in Scotland for a very powerful reason. What you're looking at is Salisbury Crag. So those of you who've been to Scotland know what you're looking at, which is part of the mountain Arthur's Seat that overlooks the city. Now, Frederick Douglass, when he's on the run the first time, he's on the run, as we know, for publishing his first autobiography in April 1845 in Boston, when he takes the political decision that is a potentially life and death decision for his family to name names. Rather, up to that point, he'd been ambiguous. Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey, Frederick Douglass, as he was reborn into freedom, talking ambiguously and not specifically naming slaveholders. By telling his story, by naming names, his family was in jeopardy, so he took to water and he traveled in Ireland, Scotland, England, and Wales. Now, when he was in Scotland, he fell in love with Scotland. And there's many reasons why he fell in love with Scotland. Perhaps the most famous reason is because, as you all know, born into slavery as Frederick Bailey, he's reborn in freedom, a freedom that he well knew was a freedom in name only, but one in which he became Frederick Douglass because his friend, Nathan Johnson in New Bedford, said to him, at that point he was Frederick Johnson, that was his pseudonym at that point, he said, "You can't be Frederick Johnson, there's too many of us. I've got a name for you." And he was reading Sir Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake. And James Douglas, the Highland chieftain who fought the oppressive English, is the heroic warrior. And he said, "You should be named Douglas after James Douglas." So when Douglas came to Scotland, he said one of the famous lines that he said repeatedly, whether he said it in Edinburgh, whether he said it in Perth, or when he said it in Ayr, which is a tiny place, which is where he learned of his youngest daughter's passing, Douglas repeatedly said, "I come here to the land of freedom, where there is not a stream, a vale, or a valley that does not speak of the bloody contest for slavery and freedom." Now, Scotland has its hands drenched in blood. It was a nation founded on slave trading. It was a nation that profited horrifically from the trafficking of enslaved children, women, and men. There are infirmaries. Edinburgh is very famous for its medical history, and one of the most important infirmaries that's in the centre of Scotland and in Edinburgh was founded specifically, we can look at the printed record of the accountancy, of the selling of children in the Caribbean. Douglas knew this history. When he came to Scotland, and he was in Scotland for about 6 months, he was appointed as Scotland's anti-slavery agent. He deliberately manipulated the myth of Scotland as the land of freedom to expose it as the hell of corruption. Now, the decision he makes with Salisbury Crag and Arthur's Seat is a very powerful one that we're trying to honour in the legacy of Scotland. Now, as you can see, Salisbury Crag, just in front of Arthur's Seat, sits over the city. At 4 a.m. on May 16th, 1846, Mr. Douglas, who is 27, when he comes back to the city and he's 60, he said, "It took me a far longer to climb this mountain than it did when I was 27. He gets up at 4 a.m. on May 16th, and with two white women, two Quakers, Jane Smeal and Eliza Wigham, they take their spades and they climb the side of Salisbury Crag. And this is what it looked like in 1846. And they decide that they are going to tell the story of corruption and white slave trading in Scotland on the green sward of Scotland itself. They take their spades and they map out a very long sign. They start at 4 a.m. and they're working away till 7 a.m. And there is a very big destitute homeless community living on the mountain in this period. Edinburgh was a place full of slum poverty, as well as rich royals who were imported from England. Scottish locals were suffering from destitution and starvation. They helped him. And he printed into the landscape, "Send back the money." Now, "send back the money" made him famous in Scotland. Douglas wasn't just famous in a tiny way, he was a legend. He would walk the streets of Edinburgh, he would walk the streets of Perth, the streets of Aberdeen, the streets of Arbroath, and little kids would come up and tug on his shirt and say to him, "Send back the money." Now, this is a folk song that is still sung and performed today, and the kirk is the Scottish, stands for the Scottish church, and this is a conversation that is the folk song that's recorded, and at the bottom you see, "Enter Frederick Douglass, I say send back that money." So he carved it into the greensward of the mountain. He's immediately caught by a bailiff who is looking up and at 7 a.m. sees this sign on the side of the mountain. He's taken before a magistrate and he's immediately released because he has very high up connections in Edinburgh at that point. Now, he's released, but he goes on to do more. What he decides to do is he gets some red paint, and Edinburgh is filled with very rich mansions that are still today protected. They are beautiful, they are listed buildings, and they are all profiting from the trade of slavery in the Caribbean and the New World. He takes his red paint, he's on his own this time, and he paints all their stoops blood red. He does that in Arbroath, in Kirkcaldy, in Paisley, all across Scotland to tell Scotland to send back that money. Now, he fails. The white Scottish church is far too greedy. All that money from Louisiana is far too helpful. And they do not send it back. But he raises Scotland to what one white commentator describes as a fever pitch in terms of anti-slavery campaigning. Now, when he's in Scotland, he suffers terrible emotional struggle. He's 27. He's thousands of miles away from his family. He's only 8 years out of slavery. And when he's in the city, one of the powerful stories we wanted to tell was how he survived in that city and what kept his body and soul together. This is how the street looks. So when he set out from his spade, this is about a 10-minute walk to Salisbury Crag. He left this building. This is how it looks today. And this is what beautifully is above that door as of 6 months ago. Now, Frederick Douglass's story we told in Scotland. This is a museum in the center of Scotland, and many people in this room came to Scotland to see it there. And we wanted to tell this story of Douglass's strike for freedom. Now, this handsome young man here was really at the heart of making this happen because we wanted to actually take the original manuscripts and have them in glass cases in Scotland as a world first. Douglas wanted to move his family to Scotland, had his freedom not been purchased, against his wish in 1846. He said, "Edinburgh is the most beautiful city I've ever seen. Here I walk a free man." And so at one point he was contemplating living in Scotland, and at the age of 76, he said, "For all of my life, while I am an Eastern Shore man, a Scottish heart beats under these ribs." Now, what I wondered was, I didn't know, was who would come? How many would come? Who's heard of Frederick Douglass? And the powerful truth was that many people had heard of him. Every event we did, and we did numerous public lectures, we did various group meetings with people with dementia, we worked with community projects that working with homeless communities, people came in, everything had standing room only. We've been doing walking tours and freedom trails of the city where we've mapped everywhere he spoke, and also everywhere Ida B. Wells spoke, Ellen Craft spoke, Moses Roper spoke, other seminal black freedom fighters in the city. They're now running indefinitely to meet demand, and rooms were crushed with people. Now, what I learned in doing this was, remember Mr. Douglas getting that letter from 10-year-old Annie, that hard-hearted man said he must die. They took him half a mile from the jail and they hung him. Douglas gets that letter in March 1860 in Ayr. Now, when Douglas comes to Scotland, he is supported by whites, by William Lloyd Garrison, the seminal figure of white abolition, who Douglas had a very complicated relationship with. And as the Dr. Evans collection beautifully shows us, we have the eulogy Douglas writes when Garrison passes, in which he's tussling with himself because he's dealing with the pain of their very fraught relationship. What you see and understand by looking at this material is Douglass's belief in humanitarian social justice. As he said, truth and right is of no race, color, creed, or nation. White abolitionists in Scotland, England, Ireland, and Wales in the 19th century cared only for their genteel settings. They typically supported events in breakfasts, in elite settings. Douglas abandons that, and when he's in Scotland, he stops going on the official tour, he gets himself a horse, and he goes to tiny places. He goes and speaks to coal miners, to weavers. He wants to hear about their destitution. And so when he's in Ayr, which is a tiny place, when he talks there, he's about to give a talk. He's just heard the news that Annie has died. And what we found in the journey of learning and working with this material is we found the letter that was written by a journalist who says, "We crammed ourselves into this church." How many people were crammed in this church? This church was about a quarter of the size of this room. It still stands today. 2,000 people crammed in to hear him. 2,000 people, that's more than the population of the town. And they said, the newspaper reporter says, "The great man got up, stood up, broke down, and did this 20 times. So what we wanted to honor was Douglass's story, and why everything was packed out in Scotland is there was ancestral memory. People came up to me after talks and said, "My great-great-grandmother told me about Frederick Douglass coming to this city." So what we have here, we have a website, and all technically gifted people did this beautiful interactive map of all the places that not only Douglas, but also that Black Freedom Struggle campaigners were involved in Scotland and the activism that they did. This story I just wanted to share with you before I finish my long ramble is that when Douglas was in Scotland at 27, as I said, he fought with suicidal depression all his life. And you see that in looking through the collection. You see the broken humanity of Douglas as he works with and continues to struggle on with his intergenerational trauma. Is in this hotel that's on the left here in 1846, he has such terrible soul-killing depression. He writes to Harriet, the woman he took on as his adopted sister, and he says, "Let no one have this awful pain in the mind. Am I to be persecuted with this pain in my mind all my life? There is no living for me." And what he does is, if you've got good eyesight, you can see that big road in the middle, is he walks down the street there and he finds a violin shop. And he buys a violin, and he goes to an area called Leith, which is the harbor area of Scotland, and he makes great friends with all the sailors, and they teach him all the naughty versions of the Robert Burns songs that he loved. And he said, "Let anybody who has pain in their soul play the violin, play Robbie Burns, and they'll be lively as a cricket and as loving as a lamb." Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.